Hi, Matt.
Hey, Rehan. How's it going?
Not bad. I'm Rehan Salam with Economics 21, a columnist for The Daily and a blogger for National Review, and I'm here with Matthew Iglesias.
Yes, I'm Matthew Iglesias. I'm a fellow at the Center for American Progress, a blogger at Think Progress, and I don't know, I probably write other things.
And Matt and I are both very interested in America's fiscal future, and that is going to be one of the many things we discuss in what I hope will be a wide-ranging and entertaining dialogue.
Yes, that's the dream.
Matt, is there anything that you'd like to start with?
Well, you know, I thought we would just start with the obvious, right? Paul Ryan is out with his Path to Prosperity this week, and it's, I don't know, attracted a lot of excitement, a lot of attention. Are you excited?
I am very excited. I think that he's kicked off what is, going to be a very important conversation about the future of the welfare state. I don't think that his Path to Prosperity is where we're going to end up necessarily, but I do think that it gives some indication of where a lot of us hope to go. I'm very eager to see what the response is going to be. President Obama has talked about issuing a plan of his own, and we've heard from David Plouffe, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, this idea that the White House is going to propose what they call smart deficit reductions that aim to protect infrastructure spending and education spending, but that also will involve fairly serious cuts to the growth of Medicare. So it'll be very interesting to see what the next move is.
Yes. Yes, it will. And I will say, to be fair to Paul Ryan, that the last time you and I talked in a media framework, we were on an NPR show. And, I was saying that one could criticize the Obama administration's initial budget proposal from various perspectives, but that the fact of the matter is that it was a budget proposal. It involved lower deficits than the current policy baseline. And so now, really, the ball was on the other side's court, and that, unless or until Republicans wrote down some kind of alternative with lower taxes and less debt, there wasn't a great deal to talk about. So now that they have, I do think that was the step in the iterative process that had to be taken. I'm not really sure that this year is actually a great time to be talking about this issue, but agenda formation is a little mysterious. It's true, I think, that even though a lot of progressives are not excited about the idea of the administration coming up with a counterproposal, that it is sort of incumbent on the White House to do so.
You feel very strongly about this. I mean, if I am reading you correctly, your feeling is that the fact that we're talking about austerity, the fact that we're talking about fiscal consolidation in this climate is bordering on sickening and insane. I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit, and then maybe I could let you know why I think that this is exactly the right time to talk about it.
Sure. I to some extent, to use less colorful language, have been influenced in this by some reading I've recently done of Frank Baumgartner's research in political science on agenda instability and political attention. It just turns out to be the case that the question of what are we talking about and what are we paying attention to is actually very significant, that the political system, can only do so much at any given time. And so that even though, I certainly think it's true that in an ideal world, you would have your long-term projections adding up, and it's always been a good thing for think tanks and so on and so forth to play around with. The fact of the matter is that there's nothing in 2011 America that I think where people are being harmed by the fact that the current policy baseline is so unbalanced. Obviously, at some point, there will be a problem caused by that, and at that point or before, you would need to deal with it. But I'm not persuaded that there's anything to be gained by some sort of preemptive effort, or that there's any reasonable prospects for success. I mean, I think there's a sort of logic to this political game where we're now moving tit for tat and everyone sort of has to. But, you know, consensus isn't going to be reached. Even if it was reached, it wouldn't do much good. And if you look at the nature of the plans that are being kicked around, to some extent, I think they implicitly recognize that by actually kicking the toughest changes down the table. Not down the table. That's not the right metaphor. You kick the can down the road. And that's inherent to the process.
You know, I'm also a big fan of the whole agendas and instability idea. And, you know, my reading on it is this idea that, you know, in a moment of crisis, then you actually have these agendas that are on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And that's why, or that's, you know, the premise is that's why the work that policymakers do, policy entrepreneurs do, during a period when, for example, you know, not everyone was thinking very deeply about health system reform for much of the, you know, the decade and a half after President Clinton's failed health reform
right.
effort. But there were some people who were thinking about it pretty deeply, and there were some people who were also very sophisticated about the political strategy involved. And some of those people really helped very powerfully to frame the debate. So, you know, for example, Jacob Hacker had a pretty big influence on the plan that was eventually adopted by a lot of folks in the labor movement and by the Edwards campaign, and that helped, you know, move the conversation along.
Exactly.
And my feeling is that, you know, when you're talking about when is the right time for fiscal consolidation, I think that, you know, the right time in theory is when times are flush, when the economy is growing, et cetera. But I think the trouble is that you're never going to have the political coalition in place to achieve, you know, any kind of real consolidation, any kind of retrenchment when times are flush. Because, you know, when you're swimming in tax revenues, Republican governors as well as Democratic governors are going to want to strengthen their position by improving the quality of public services, or, you know, forget about improving the quality of public services, just hiring more public sector workers,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, that's a crude proxy for improving the quality of public services. And I think that that, in a way, is what we saw over the course of the 2000s. Here's a period where, you know, depending on
right. No, I mean, you know what? I will say for state government, you know, I buy that, and I think I've written that there's something. I certainly think that it is macroeconomically counterproductive to have so many state legislatures and governors moving towards such dramatic retrenchment right now. But at the same time, I do think that realistically, you know, there's nothing to be done about that. I mean, there may be something to be done about that, but not sort of at the state level that, you know, if you are ever going to reduce the outlays of state government, it's going to happen in the depths of serious recessions, you know, even though that's not in principle the best time to be doing it. But the federal government faces a, you know, a different kind of budget constraint from state governments. And that what we've traditionally seen is that when large deficits are creating high interest rates, that, you know, we had this in 1990 and again in 1993 and, you know, throughout a period when there was a real, you know, there was a crowding out problem. So politicians, you know, moved to address the problem. Whereas right now, they're just, you know, there isn't a problem. And so it's difficult to see what we hope to gain here.
I guess there's a concern that there's going to be this very rapid takeoff in terms of the weight of mandatory expenditures, mm-hmm. and that this is going to force, you know, sharp increases in the tax burden for future taxpayers, and that now there's this relatively brief window of time when you might be able to make some, you know, fairly serious changes while insulating current and near-term retirees, but that window of time is actually closing pretty quickly. That's the basic premise that people
but
are advancing.
But this is what, think, what to me, I mean, there's a million things in Paul Ryan's Path to Prosperity. You know, there's a sort of, you know, sort of extraneous stuff, repealing elements of the Dodd-Frank bill. There's some, you know, kind of placeholder tax reform. But the core thing, right, I mean, his contribution to the debate, I guess, over the size and scope of the American welfare state is this Medicare plan, really, right? I mean, that's the thing, the idea that he's putting on the agenda. And I just don't see what...
Well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of, you know, I think that also PPACA also put Medicare on the agenda. I think that there's pretty universal agreement that it is the driver.
Sure. Yeah. No, but I mean, he has a distinctive idea
that's true.
About Medicare.
Yeah.
And that's, you know...
He has a distinctive idea that's part of a broader family of ideas for reforming Medicare by trying to restrain its cost growth over time. There are a lot of different ideas as to how to go about doing that, but he has an idea that, you know, it has a family resemblance with a bunch of different plans, including the so-called Rivlin-Ryan plan, which is distinct from the plan on the P2P, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I take your point. He has a particular way of going about it.
And so, I mean, there's two sort of aspects to this, right? One is a structural change in how Medicare, you know, is done, right? I mean, to move away from it being a single-payer insurance program and toward it being a subsidy for senior citizens to buy private health insurance. And then the other is simply to put a quantitative limit on its growth. And it just seems to me, looking at it, that, you know, all of the spending reduction that he's obtaining simply comes from the fact that he's put an extraordinarily aggressive quantitative limit on it, starting in the future. And so I wonder what it is that, given that right now, if you look at the current law baseline, the deficit picture is much, much better than the current policy. But that's because we don't take that seriously because we say, well, everybody knows that, you know, doctor reimbursement rates are going to keep going up. Everybody knows that this really biting alternative minimum tax isn't going to take into effect. And so what is to be achieved by just sort of promising that 15 years in the future we're going to enact a draconian Medicare cutback when we don't believe our current promises to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question, and it also relates to a lot of the debates that we've had around recent big-ticket reform proposals, including the president's new health law,
right,
about proposals that will go into effect after a theoretical second Obama term. You know, a lot of the kind of painful measures, including the excise tax on high-cost health plans, et cetera. It's true, you know, you see a lot of folks who are putting these ideas in place in the future. The one thing about the Ryan proposal is that it actually puts a lot of draconian cuts in, not all of which I endorse, actually, you know, in a much shorter time scale. So it envisions very deep cuts to Medicaid, for example.
Yes,
over
no,
the next 10 years, which may or may not be realistic. And it also proposes slashing a wide range of popular domestic discretionary programs. It takes on a series of constituencies that, you know, are widely and rightly recognized as Republican constituencies, for example, a lot of rural farm supports. And while it isn't as hard on them as it is on future Medicare beneficiaries, you know, in the sense of, you know, kind of tightening cost growth, it does make pretty deep cuts, deeper than anything that we've seen in recent years. So I think that, you know, they're going on a very broad front attack on a lot of pretty popular programs, which is one reason, by the way, why I think a lot of people described the proposal as courageous, which is
sure. And look, I mean, there's an ongoing, you know, dispute about that. I'm happy to concede Paul Ryan's courage, I guess, in promising to help giant banks and rich people at the expense of the poor.
And
the middle class
to kind of reduce payments to farmers and other
which is all good. No, but I mean, in terms of, you know, talking about the I mean, I don't think there's anything. I think he, in the long term, claims that domestic discretionary spending is going to, like, shrink to 4% of GDP or something, but on some decades-long time horizon. And, you know, that's through no – well, for one thing, I think that's stupid. But, I mean, that's also just not, you know, actually how policy gets made in the real world. You know, there's these appropriation cycles, and we'll see what happens. But it's the Medicare – you know, I mean, he's proposing, on the one hand...
Medicare is definitely the heart of the proposal.
To drastically cut the spending on the Medicare, and at the same time, to completely restructure it. And I think that what he would like me to think, and what he would like to be true, is that this privatizing of Medicare will actually save large sums of money, will be some much more efficient way of delivering a benefit to elderly people, and that's why it becomes plausible to talk about the kind of reduced outlays.
I think that's not quite the dynamic that Chairman Ryan and the other folks who advocate this approach envision happening. I don't think that you're saying that it's about kind of cutting the administrative costs or what have you. But I think that there is a danger of some confusion here. I think the basic idea is that saying that there is going to be a pretty fixed amount of money that we're going to spit out to people, that's going to vary by health status and age, et cetera, but it's going to be a pretty fixed amount, that this is going to lead to business model innovation. This is going to force a level of discipline, fiscal discipline, that will itself lead to some organizational discipline on the part of healthcare providers. So basically, everyone's going to be more cost-conscious.
But why is it that current promises that reimbursement rates are going to plummet in the future have not and have never spurred that kind of... What those promises have spurred historically has been lobbying, not organizational.
Right, and I think that... and actually, this is a very good point that we should get into, but to address that point straight away, I think the issue is that with Medicare fee-for-service, because it actually is such a big part of the purchasing that happens in the health system right now, it actually creates this funny situation in which it's much harder for private payers, none of which are on the same scale, in order to create an alternative. So, you have providers who can always say that, well, look, Medicare fee-for-service is such a big part of the landscape right now, we're going to have to organize our practice around the way that they do business, or we can continue to do that, and there's no other provider that actually
has providers are generally getting more generous rates from these private.
Yeah, that's true, but they still have the alternative. They still have, they're still able to have, kind of a fifth of the system organized,
Sure, but if you were a provider, right? I mean, if you had a way to deliver services at a lower cost than you currently are, right? But to charge non-Medicare payers for it, that would be a huge profit opportunity right now, because the Medicare payments are much closer to marginal costs. And some people do it, right? I mean, in the big cities, right, in New York and L.A., where you have a lot of rich people, some doctors do manage to engage in the innovation of refusing to take Medicare patients so as to spend time with high-paying patients. And then Medicaid has even lower reimbursement rates, so it's much more common to see people who won't accept those and just focus on the higher-paying clients. But in no case are we seeing that create the kind of innovations you might be hoping.
Well, actually, the thing is that almost everyone who is consuming medical insurance, it is going to be subsidized, whether it's happening through the tax system or whether or not it's happening more directly. So, I mean, I think that, the issue is that you're creating this situation in which you're, strongly encouraging overconsumption across the board. And I think that the idea is that if you were to actually reduce the extent of a subsidy, then you would actually, that kind of increase in cost consciousness across the board. You're talking about pretty large numbers of people who are actually not in that universe of people who are paying out of pocket. So it's true that can have this kind of, if you look at LASIK, for example, LASIK is a terrain where it's not subsidized insurance, and so you see actually a dramatic decline in costs. I think that, overall, that universe in which people are not receiving subsidized coverage, you actually do see a fair bit of innovation in terms of kind of cost savings. And I think that the idea is that, hopefully we'll see that spread throughout the system if you actually, make those subsidies narrower, predictable, and thus you encourage that kind of cost consciousness.
Right, but I mean, I think it's worth being clearer on what it is this looks like. I mean, particularly if you if you eliminate the subsidies that exist on the tax side while drastically reducing the subsidies that exist via Medicare, you were talking about increasing. People will become more cost conscious qua consumers. But you also really will eliminate or substantially roll back, the main function of having a healthcare policy, which is to say that people who get sick and need healthcare are able to get treatments that they need. I mean, that's what that, that, that's
I,
what
I have
this,
to say. I disagree pretty
that's
strongly.
What this comes
it reminds
I
me of how people talk about the mortgage interest deduction. I mean, if you look at Canada, where they don't have a mortgage interest deduction along the lines of what we have here in the United States, they have rates of home ownership which are actually right around, if not a little.
I completely agree with you on home ownership. But I mean, if you look at
here, it's not obvious to me that suddenly people are not going to be able to afford medical treatments, etc. I think that it's more likely that you're going to see the market adjust in a way where you're going to have a new sort of new providers that wouldn't have found it sensible to go into that field before. You're going to find new business models. You're going to find a lot of people who are also people are going to economize at the margin in terms of what they think they need. But I think that you're going to potentially get a better outcome in that scenario as well.
I mean, that just seems like a wild, totally evidence-free plan. I guess I see what you're saying. Maybe hypothetical innovations will come in, but I mean, I think you can understand. Well, for one thing, you can certainly understand why the plan is, not to do this to currently elderly people because they wouldn't vote for it because it's crazy. It's at odds with the way.
A little funny, just because I think that there's inevitably going to be a transition. I mean,
There's definitely inevitably going to be a transition. I mean, which is why even under Ryan's plan, the initial spending cuts are quite modest, but it goes on and on. But
I think that the 8-year transition that's envisioned for for example the high cost health plans, made sense because you could say that it was purely political, but also because people are going to have to adjust in a variety of ways in order to build the exchanges.
Sure. This is what I'm saying. What is being proposed here is a leap into the dark, into a universe where healthcare treatments that currently exist, people will not be able to buy. Rich people will be able to buy them, and indeed, since their income taxes will be lower, they will have an increased ability. But, working class people, middle class people who fall seriously ill won't be able to buy the kinds of care that's currently available, and we are hoping/asserting that miracle cures will arise, but we're also not doing anything. I think we might reach some consensus around the fact that there are lots of kinds of policy barriers to the more efficient delivery of care.
You see, though, that someone is going to have to pay for the miracle cures in either scenario, right? I mean, and I think that the issue is
sure.
But I mean, for
current things, I mean, I think that it's really a nice thing about America today. That if you are poor and you are pregnant, that you can get some prenatal care, for example, thanks to Medicaid, and that having drastic cutbacks in spending on that, seems like a dubious kind of proposition.
I have to say, I agree that it's a very good thing, and I think that the idea is that we will continue to do those good things. It's just that we're going to shift responsibility for doing some of those good things, for example, to state governments, so that people who are close
well,
to
and
the
I definitely
and
don't
the case
and I mean,
are going
I,
to be
I,
able to
I,
make
I,
those
I,
decisions. And there are a variety of other structural reforms that we're going to need as well. For example, the idea that state governments facing a counter-cyclical scenario will be able to borrow against future transfers. That's another idea that I think is a very good and important idea. But I think the idea of shifting some of that responsibility away from federal taxpayers over the longer term, the idea.
Well, sure, but you just kind of yada yada past the part though where you need some kind of cyclical stabilization element. I mean, which I completely agree. But if you're not fanatically obsessed with coming up with plans to make giant tax cuts for rich people affordable, then the fact that we don't have that level of countercyclical stabilization makes me very, very leery to say, well, we're going to put even more Medicaid onto states so that, when there are recessions, when there's an increase in need, we're not able to reach for it. I mean, this is a very serious problem.
That Medicaid is a pretty well-structured program right now, and that actually there isn't significant room for cost savings, then, I mean, it's an honest disagreement between the two of us. I actually think that there is tremendous room
there's room for some kind of savings. But, I mean, again, if you look at the cost per patient that's happening in Medicaid, I mean, right now it's tiny compared to what's happening anyplace else. And, to say that, my big takeaway about the United States of America in 2011 is that too much money is going to poor people's healthcare spending via Medicaid seems a little
I don't think that's the debate. I think that actually we can imagine, some state governments choosing to spend quite a bit more. I think that the real issue is the misalignment of incentives. You have a situation in which actually state governments don't have a very powerful incentive to actually build more efficient, leaner, more effective
systems. Those are very serious problems, and you know should possibly be addressed rather than phasing out federal spending. I mean, it's a question of. You know, I think that what's being done here is that you're pointing out the existence of, you have programs that exist, and they're not perfect. There are flaws. It's possible to improve them. And that instead of talking about concrete, specific ways to improve them, you're talking about proposing very large, basically arbitrary cuts in overall spending, and then just kind of with a hope and a prayer that means that services are going to be delivered more efficiently. I see it the exact...
Matt, come on. Matt, the idea of decentralization, the idea of allowing people to experiment, the idea is that you create a broad approach that gives as much room as possible to policymakers and individuals and households in order to kind of find solutions that fit them well and that fit changing circumstances. So basically having this very broad, simple framework is assuming that, you know what, we do not know exactly what's going to happen in the near future. But what we do know is how much we think taxpayers can bear in terms of a tax burden in the future. And we're going to plan around that rather than plan to, whatever happens, whatever new treatments emerge, et cetera, we are just going to definitely cover it no matter what. And we're going to pretend that we're going to be able to somehow make this all add up. We're going to have to radically ratchet up the tax burden.
Well, I haven't done any of those things. I mean, it just doesn't...
I think that's how some of us see it. You know, we see that actually...
Yes, no, really I completely agree. The way Paul Ryan sees it is that you keep existing tax policy in place and then make it somewhat more favorable to high-income individuals requires draconian cuts in Medicare, which I completely agree with. It very much does. I think what should be acknowledged here is that this is a dispute. You know, it's driven by, as you were just saying there, by concern with tax policy, that the current programs we have are not going to be consistent in the long term with the level of taxation that Paul Ryan is comfortable with. And that's what's, sort of driving the chain here. It's not that there's necessarily this confidence that these miracles will arise, but it's a belief that, we have to radically restructure these programs in order to keep taxes low.
Yeah, it's very
simple.
I think that it's fair to say that, look, we should have a much higher tax burden. That's perfectly consistent with having, more prosperous, high-growth society, and, that should be where we should place our efforts. And I think that that's a disagreement.
Sure, right, but I'm just... It is, right. And the point is that I think that is the nub of the disagreement here, which is not about Medicare savings per se. I mean, I am definitely a believer in the idea that we need to look hard at the public programs we have. We have to work on ways to make them more efficient. That I think this is something that progressives sometimes underplay, which is that, if the idea is to deliver services to people, it's very important to look at the efficacy with which that's being done. But precisely the reason that, I prefer to talk about concrete steps that, we think we have evidence that doing this differently will improve something, is preferable, is that I think it's possible and desirable to raise additional revenue and also take in additional immigrants as the main way of preserving the, basic structure of what we have here.
One thing about, there's a lot to talk about there, but the one thing about taking in additional immigrants as a strategy is, one of the issues when you're thinking about a dependency ratio is when you're taking in immigrants as children, for example, the cost associated with educating them, and of course, you're going to have to also kind of address the cost of retirement and related expenditures later on. So it's not obvious to me that I think that, there could be all kinds of reasons why we want to accept more immigrants, but I've never totally understood the fiscal case for it. I mean, you could also say that
immigrants, sort of
later arrivals, they tend to have a higher fertility rate. But of course, they tend to approach that of natives pretty quickly, you know, within the space of a generation or two. So, I mean, is it fair? Do you really see immigration as a kind of strategy for addressing a long-term fiscal imbalance?
Well, I mean, I don't see that as the primary reason to do it, but it's not just immigration's impact on demographics, but I mean immigration, particularly immigration of higher skilled workers or workers who are just more complementary to the current pool that we have, you know, also increases the growth rate in a per capita level. It's a more efficient labor market.
Well, that's an area where we agree. I mean, I'm definitely,
you know, which is something that,
in,
that we should be doing.
You know, welcoming more high skilled immigrants.
Right.
I've never kind of bought the idea that it would make that big a difference on the fiscal side. Although, you know, I do buy that. You know, kind of if it does, kind of help kick out.
It depends. It depends who it is.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, you could tailor immigration policy more specifically to improving the fiscal status of retirement programs. You know, our current policy vis-a-vis who comes in, what kind of taxes they pay, what kind of benefits they get is not at all structured with that in mind. But you could certainly, you know, try to say, well, we could become much more welcoming to people who want to come here legally, but make them take some kind of hit on the retirement benefits that they will be earning in the future in exchange for taxes that they pay, which, you know, would be I think a positive sum interaction for everybody involved. You know,
just to be very clear, I don't want to move away too far from
yeah.
The Medicare discussion, just to kind of put a button on it. I think that your view, and tell me if I'm mischaracterizing it, is that talking about serious concrete proposals to rein in Medicare expenditures is a lot better than the hand-wavy approach of just saying that we are going to reduce these expenditures by X amount by, you know, kind of having this kind of very kind of fixed amount that we're giving to premium support and growing it at this, you know, kind of very crazily low level. Because that latter approach is just hand-wavy and just imagines that all these great things are going to happen, whereas the concrete approach is trying to use the best evidence that we have at hand in order to take a realistic shot at reducing those expenditures. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, that's part of it, but I mean, there's actually two different things in play there. And one is simply just that insofar as we're going to rely on caps in overall spending, which I think there's a case for, actually a pretty good case for saying we should have a global budget cap that's consistent with the basic single-payer structure of Medicare. Medicare is actually quite unusual, as I understand it, in being sort of unbudgeted, you know, the way that it is, where it's just however many procedures happen to get done. You know, the formula goes out that the Canadian version of Medicare, you know, has – you know, there's a certain amount of money appropriated for it, and it pays for an amount of services that's dictated by that, and then there's some effort to ascertain, you know, what's a cost-effective use of those dollars.
Yeah.
So that would be my approach to capping the growth of the program, would be to separate out this idea of, like, you know, of what are we going to cap it at, what's realistic, then how is that cap implemented, but keep a unified structure in place. I think that what the Affordable Care Act does is a, you know, different kind of hand wave, where since you don't have a real expenditure cap, it's not clear that any of the specific changes ever get done.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there have been a lot of ideas, including an idea from three economists, health economists based at the University of Minnesota. They wrote a wonderful book called Bringing Market Prices to Medicare for AEI Press. And the idea there was that let's set a fixed benefit and then allow Medicare fee-for-service and private providers, Medicare Advantage plans, to bid on offering that fixed benefit. And the Medicare premium support model is different still because it's saying that, you know, no, we're not going to set this fixed benefit. We're going to have this amount of premium support. And, you know, basically you're going to have to spend more than that sort of if you choose, you know, benefit level X. So benefit level X becomes markedly more expensive and the premium support level doesn't keep up with that, then you're going to have to pay for it out of pocket whether or not you use, you know, kind of plan X or plan Y. I The reason why I prefer that form of hand-waviness is because I believe that it allows for more experimentation and more diversity in terms of the approaches taken by providers. And you know, that is totally hand-wavy. It's the definition of it. But I think that it's the right kind of decentralized hand-waviness, as opposed to centralized hand-waviness, which you know, I just think is not going to yield the right outcome. Because I think that if you say that, you know, look, we are going to protect this basic benefit no matter what, I think that that's where you get actually the more severe political economy problem, which is one issue that you've raised that I actually find very persuasive and interesting, and I think that it's something that you know, one needs to guard against. So why don't you tell us a bit about, you have argued that all you're doing with the Ryan Care approach, as you call it, is actually introducing a new set of powerful interests that will lobby the political system to actually increase spending on Medicare more than what we see right
now.
Well,
I wouldn't say increase it even more, but that, you know, you're going to create this set of sort of insurance company middlemen who, I mean, initially, because this is part of the thing, it's, you know, in the first couple years that we're moving to this premium support model, there's still a huge amount of money being spent and you know, very little cuts in outlays because it has to be phased in. And I think that what you're going to see is, you know, you're going to have people who are subscribed to these plans, and they are not going to want to start consuming less in the way of healthcare services. And the insurers themselves are not going to want to see the level of subsidy going to them go down. And it's going to be just like the current, you know, American Medical School Association plus elderly people lobby to endlessly delay implementing cuts in reimbursement rates, that you're going to see doctors plus insurance companies plus elderly people as, you know, the new lobby for, we won't call it doc fix, we'll call it, you know, premium support fix or whatever. And you know, you just haven't actually resolved this sort of basic political economy issue that affects the current structure of the program.
Yeah, I think that that's why I think the key thing is to connect very vividly just the expenses that are going out with the taxes that people are paying into the system. And I think that, you know, the big political economy with a very heavy deficit spending is that you're able to mask that relationship.
Yes. I think that that's true. And I think, I mean, in an ideal political world, whatever the federal subsidy to healthcare is, and however it's delivered, you know, everyone would get it. It wouldn't be that, like, it's one system for people who are old and it's a different system for people who are young. It would be one thing, although old people use more of it. And it would have some specific tax, you know, that's paying for it. And you would be budgeting year to year, you know, same as you do with most things. And so you would be saying, well, either we're going to need higher taxes or we're going to cut this down or whatever. And you'd have, you know, there's never really optimal trade-off making. But what we have right now is senior citizens who are under the impression that they paid for Medicare.
I'm sorry. In a passing comment on your blog, you suggested that Lawrence Kotlikoff's purple health plan is, as far as you can tell, pretty similar to the new health law.
Well, I would say that, to clarify, I would say that it's similar to, you know, the germ of an idea of the new health law before the new health law became a presidential campaign proposal, became a piece of legislation, became amended by committees, so on and so forth, but that it's a similar concept to me.
Yeah, I was struck by the plan. I mean, you know, Lawrence Kotlikoff has been offering a plan like this for a pretty long time. He actually co-authored a big story, I believe it was co-authored by Neil Ferguson for the New Republic some years ago, in which he was proposing something along those lines. And I really like the plan, which, if I recall correctly, is a plan that basically voucherizes the entire health system so that, you know, the revenue from the tax exclusion and, you know, all kinds of other buckets of revenue are used to fund vouchers for all Americans adjusted by health status that are then used to purchase insurance from private insurers. And it's interesting because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how Ryan's vision for these, you know, kind of very strict caps on growth in Medicare premium support is in fact very similar to the new health law. And One thing that I find interesting is just that I think that the new health law, had the new health law been a universal exchange model, had it been something that more transparently took the revenue from the tax exclusion and then applied it to you know, vouchers that
something more like income the wine status, et cetera,
I tend to think that that would have been a much, much, much better model than the health law, and that the big flaw that a lot of us saw in the health law is that it creates a very rickety structure that isn't likely to survive being road tested.
Right, but
that,
I mean,
actually,
the,
because
the
subsidies are higher.
Well, as you recall, the big flaw in the Wyden-Bennett proposal, which was along those lines, was that no one in Congress wanted to vote for it. So. I mean, I think a lot of people, writers, like, but I mean, that was really what I meant about Kolakoff's plan. That, you know, I mean, in a sense, the Affordable Care Act is like the grandson of Wyden-Bennett. But in another way, it's very, very different. But the difference, you know, is not accounted for, I think, by its architects not recognizing the virtue of a more comprehensive approach. It's accounted for by the fact that the majority of people really strongly oppose the idea of any sort of large-scale change in the current status of their health insurance.
One thing that depresses me is the iterative nature of all this stuff, so that during the 2008 presidential campaign, John McCain proposed rolling back the tax exclusion and using it for refundable tax credits. Then the Obama campaign spent a lot of money attacking this idea, and then, you know, David Axelrod explains to folks in the Obama White House that, look, we can't really do anything that profound the tax exclusion because we spent a bunch of money during the campaign attacking it. And then you're backed up into this position where you have to advocate a plan that is, you know, very much seventh best versus the kind of plan that you'd want to put in place if you wanted to get the incentives right, particularly on the tax side.
Yeah, and, I mean, look, in an ideal world, you know, when McCain came out with his plan and when people hit him for it, then what you would have gotten was a slight repositioning by John McCain to say, well, all right, liberals, if a little bit more regulation of how these tax credits are used will make you happy, you know, then I'll change the plan. And then everyone would have said, oh, great, John, you've actually answered our real objection to this. We're going to stop complaining.
You know, of course, that would never
tragically,
happen.
Tragically,
no
right,
matter
but
how
I mean,
much
that,
more regulation he would have, yeah. I mean,
well, no. I mean, that's not the politics.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand. Like, he didn't think that answering the wonky objection to his plan would prevent the political attacks. It's a difficult problem. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is, to some extent, this is what you get with democracy. And the problem that everyone who's tried to substantially reform the healthcare system over the past 40 years has dealt with is that the majority of people are satisfied with its operation. The majority of policy analysts seem to be very distressed with it, since it costs a lot of money and doesn't actually seem to promote good health outcomes. But, you know, it's just the fact of the matter is that the voters disagree with that assessment, which over and above the interest group politics makes it difficult to deal
with. Well, this seems like a particularly sharp point for you, because I think that, you know, you're in this spot where I think it's fair to say that you consider the Ryan approach to be deeply, deeply wrongheaded. But on the other hand, you acknowledge that, well, look, I mean, it's a situation where if you want the tax burden to be relatively low, including relatively low for high earners, then you're going to have to do something really dramatic on the spending side, particularly to Medicare. But on the other hand, I mean, I think that you will acknowledge that there hasn't been a lot of enthusiasm on the other side of the aisle about talking about the kind of tax policies that you're going to need in order to create this modernized welfare state that I think that, you know, you want
to
see.
Yeah, I mean, if you produced, this is, as I understand it, not what the Obama administration is going to come out with, but you could produce a progressive version of, you know, not a version, but a mirror image of the Ryan plan, in which you have modest tax policy changes in the near term, focused on higher taxes on the wealthy, but that then starting 10 years in the future, you're going to have a slow but steady increase in some kind of much more broad-based tax, so that the United States would end up looking, you know, over time, more like a Denmark or a Finland, with a high value-added tax, a higher tax burden and a big kind of welfare state. Although it would still be different because our spending is so much more weighted toward healthcare and national security than most countries is.
Yeah, one thing, this is a little tangential, but I mean, I think that it's interesting to me how just the way your mental model of the world has so much to do with how you look at these different issues. So, you know, my mental model of the world is one in which if you give clear rules for the road and, you know, if you know, there's a sense that there's going to be this real spending discipline, then you're going to see more innovation in terms of payment innovation, in terms of kind of offering more lower cost services, in the realm of medical care and also other realms as well. And just the idea that, you know, kind of keeping marginal tax rates low is a really, really important thing to do, whereas getting rid of tax deductions is a totally fine thing to do that could actually make us all better off. I mean, I feel like that worldview all kind of hangs together reasonably well. And I think that, you know, my sense is that your view is more that, you know, you can have a somewhat higher tax burden, but that this will spur more productivity. And that, you know, you can actually have a high road economic strategy that will lead to the same, you know, amounts of economic growth, and that the cultural specificity doesn't really matter all that much, that will basically work out. Is that a fair?
Well, I mean, I think cultural specificity matters a lot in terms of what actually happens politically, right? I mean, the United States does not, in fact, have a Denmark-like tax code or tax burden.
And also, we don't have a Denmark-like state in terms of the state.
No,
capacity.
Sure. Right. No. Yeah. I mean, all kinds of things are different. But I don't think it makes I don't know. I mean, to say that we should become, over time, a country which in some respects more resembles Denmark is precisely to say, that there should be change and that there could be change. I guess I don't. You know, I think sometimes people engage in a kind of selective defeatism about politics.
Right, you're defeatist about some things and not about others,
and not about others. And I mean, of course, that's true. You know, you have to have a differing visions of this or that. In terms of I think it's difficult when you're talking about the impact on economic growth of sort of taxation and spending on retirees. I think it's important to be careful. I mean, with a lot of kinds of public services, you can really have a debate between a high road approach and a low road approach that says, well, you know, more trains, more schools, whatever is going to have a better impact on growth than low taxes. When it comes to helping elderly people who are ill, I think it's difficult to deny that simply helping them less and not paying the taxes for it or spending the tax money on preschool or whatever would be better for economic growth, simply because disabled old people are not economically productive, you know, so you can get into a kind of like a Soylent Green type scenario. Soylent Green is made of people, which is an optimizing growth strategy, but I think not, you know, in the way that people mean it, right? I mean, that's not a meaningful increase in people's standard of living.
My worldview is that actually thinking about things in those terms, that, you know, helping people is always spending a bit more money on them, and that to spend less on them implies that you care less, is that is the wrong way to think about it, and that leads to...
Well, all right, but I mean, my specific point about elderly people, and particularly sick elderly people, is that even if you were to concede that some given expenditure of resources very much does help them, it's not clear that helping people in that situation does anything for GDP growth. It would just be it's a way of being nice.
One thing that I found interesting,
Grand Canyon, right? Like, if we didn't have all these national parks, that would, I'm pretty sure, you know, boost economic growth. But that's sort of neither here nor there in terms of deciding whether we should have them.
Yeah, I wonder.
I mean, it's relevant.
I wonder if that's true, because I guess it could enhance growth in some ways as well. But I mean, it's all
sure.
Kind of a fuzzy question. I was thinking, you know, because you're interested in comparative stuff, as I am,
sure.
And you mentioned in a very recent post something about GDP per hour worked in different countries. And
yes.
I was looking at the numbers on the OECD site, and I was really struck to see that the only countries in 2009 that had higher GDP per hour worked in the OECD were Luxembourg, Norway, Belgium, and Belgium just inches us out by 0.2%.
Yeah, but
Ireland inches us out, but then, you know, we're just a little bit ahead of the Netherlands, France, but then we're comfortably ahead of a lot of the others. And I thought that was interesting.
Well, 2009 was different. Well, 2009 was a little different in that regard from 2006. I mean, the recession impacted.
Totally. When you
for example, in Germany, you know, productivity plummeted, but there was very little increase in unemployment because they basically paid people not to work.
Right.
Whereas we paid them unemployment. We paid people to be unemployed.
It's interesting to think that we do work longer hours, but also even if you kind of have a higher share of the population unemployed, we still perform extraordinarily well. And when you think about the heterogeneity of the American workforce, when you think about the fact that it's a country with a history of enslavement and segregation, yada yada,
yeah.
I was just really struck that the United States does as well as it does. And also the erosion when you look at human capital attainment, when you look at 65-year-olds leaving the workforce versus, it's funny because, you know, different people look at these numbers in different ways. And whenever I look at these numbers, I think, wow, it's incredible that the United States does as well as it does, given all the handicaps and disadvantages that we have. And, you know, in a way, I think that it's a wonderful thing that we've had this very big, significant influx of less skilled workers. The big influx of less skilled workers has enabled a lot of high human capital women. It's complementary with a lot of our, you know, kind of most productive workers.
Yeah, well, see, I mean, I think I have a different view to you of this.
Oh, no, I think you do have a different view.
Specifically of the impact of those lower productivity workers.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's one of the major advantages that the American economy has. And, I mean, a huge strength of our economic model vis-a-vis most European countries is that we have a much larger pool. I mean, we have a large domestic market, but we also have all this international migration, which I think is an enormous boon to
the outsourcing of household labor and that kind of thing, and that also creates a lot of job opportunities.
Well, and particularly when you have the workers to
right. And you wouldn't have that opportunity to the same degree without. It's also just, you know, kind of finding new and better ways to kind of combine different types of labor across an economy. But I mean, I think that partly that, you know, again, it kind of flows into different worldviews differently. I think that you and I share the view that relatively light labor market regulations facilitates the kind of experimentation that yields you productivity enhancements at the frontier, and that if you had tighter regulations, that would be harder because you wouldn't be able to combine labor in new and heretofore unseen ways.
This was all in the context of a post about how much less money American workers at a IKEA manufacturing company make. And you know, I mean, you just saw, I mean, it's obviously always more complicated than that. But, you know, in America, there is, in fact, more work being done, in part, you know, as a result of a less regulated, less taxed market for labor.
It's also like low-wage Swedish workers tend to cluster in different domains as well. I mean, it's one thing that I thought was always – one thing I always found very interesting is just when you're looking at how many more sectors are female-dominated in Sweden than in the United States, whereas we have kind of more of a gender mix. And, you know, a lot of it's things that are – you know, they outsource a lot of household labor as well, but they do it through the state-subsidized sector, whereas we do it through this kind of gray market. So I fear that I've taken us off track a little bit here.
I don't know.
Is there anything that you've been thinking about that you've been burning to share with our viewers?
Burning to share? I don't know. Is there? How about you?
Tell us a bit about...
what do you want to share?
I feel that you and I are converging on a certain view about the role that high productivity dense cities play.
Oh yes, that's
true. I'm increasingly convinced that one of the really good ways to enhance life prospects of less skilled workers and also to improve productivity for the United States as a whole is to just get more bodies into the highest productivity cities.
This is quite true. And instead of giving my ideas on this score, which I'm holding secret, I will recommend that people look up Brian Avent's presentation that he called "Moving to Stagnation," in which he shows, you know, if you talk about, well, why is it that people move from Mexico to the United States? we feel like, well, everybody knows the answer. It's that the United States is richer than Mexico, so there's more opportunities here. But then if you look within the United States, people are not particularly moving to the richest cities. They're not moving to San Francisco. They're not moving to Boston. They're not
moving
to New York.
They're moving to areas with cheap housing.
They're moving to places where the housing is cheap. And that seems like it would have the same impact as any kind of migratory barriers, and that, you know, their work would be better utilized. Their labor power is much more needed in the Bay Area, in Washington, D.C., in Boston, in places where it's, in effect, been made too expensive to live.
Well, so before we leave the Blogging Heads audience, I was thinking that it might be fun for us to reduce our characterizations of our fellow interlocutor to something that would make an effective political soundbite. So I'm just going to say that Matt Iglesias wants to raise middle-class taxes. I think that that in itself would be fatal to your political future. Now, I want to give you an opportunity to describe what I would do, the terrible things that I would do.
So Farhan Salam wants to privatize Medicare to make tax cuts for the rich affordable.
That's pretty much, that's a fair characterization, yeah. I think that we've just engaged in a kind of mutual political destruction.
Yes.
And sadly, neither of us will ever become czar of America now, unless there's some kind of military coup.
I don't think that's an elected post.
Thank you so much for your time, Matt. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Take care.
Talk to you soon.